Collins in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, a bioethicist helps us unravel the science of pain, guided by his own experience with a traumatic injury after a motorcycle accident. Several surgeries later, the only way Travis Reeder could stay ahead of his excruciating pain was strong, regular doses of opioids. As time wore on, his doctors suggested it was time to drop the drugs. What followed was one of the worst experiences of Reeder's life. We'll talk to him about how his pain was treated, why that treatment didn't always work, and why he found himself on his own in the throes of crippling withdrawal. Our conversation starts after a short break. A tricky thing for doctors to treat because only the patient knows what it feels like. It doesn't show up in blood work, it isn't revealed by an x-ray or an MRI. Pain originates in a patient's brain, which means describing it and rating how intense it is the only way it can be communicated. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Travis Reeder's severe pain following a motorcycle accident and several surgeries was treated with opioids. Staying ahead of that pain meant doctors occasionally upping the dose. When he tried to wean himself off medication, the withdrawal was agony, and none of his doctors stepped in to help him through it. His new book is called In Pain, a bioethicist's personal struggle with opioids, and he joins us from Baltimore to talk about it. Travis, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this all started, as we said, with a motorcycle ride on a nice weekend. Tell us about the accident.
It was Memorial Day weekend in 2015, and I had just bought a new motorcycle to celebrate my shiny new faculty job at Johns Hopkins. And I just couldn't stay home. It was going to be a beautiful day, so I headed out to meet with a friend of mine. We like going into West Virginia and riding through the twisties, as we call them. And I didn't make it about three blocks that day. I was an experienced rider. I've ridden for a very long time. But I got about three blocks from home, and a young guy, a kid in a van, blew a stop sign and T-boned me, hit me squarely on the left side.
So you hear a lot of stories about people who are in shock after an accident, but you hit the ground and your foot hurt right away.
Yeah, it was a really strange experience because I remember some details of the accident really well. I remember what it looked like when my bike got hit. It was this like strange warping of space-time. And I remember landing on my back and hearing the sound of my helmet smacking against the ground. But what I remember most clearly is as soon as I slid to a stop, the bike had kind of flipped off me. I had this excruciating, exploding pain in my foot, and I was wearing armored motorcycle gear. I was wearing full leathers, the whole like race outfit, and so I have these really thick armored boots on. It was taking me far too long to get it off, and when I finally did, what I saw was something that kind of looked like it was out of a zombie movie. It was a pretty mangled foot.
And you basically, and to use a horrible medical term, you degloved, right? I mean, it's like just what you'd think. It kind of pulled off a bit.
Yeah. So, you know, there was not only so much of the foot you could see. So I do say in the book that that's one of the things I heard the EMT say, potential degloving of the left foot. And that just like echoed around my brain because I knew what degloving meant. I don't think that's actually what happened, in fact, but all they saw was a lot of missing flesh and you could see down to the bone. And so they were just kind of trying to relay enough information so that whoever was on the other end knew this was a trauma situation.
So it was pretty obvious this was immediately going to be surgical. I mean, you don't hurt your foot that way and you get it wrapped with an ACE bandage. So they rushed you to the hospital. Did you have surgery right away?
Not right away. So I was in the hospital for a very long time, in shock, in and out of consciousness with lots of drugs. And I remember thinking, boy, this is taking a long time. You know, one of the reasons is they're putting me through an MRI and doing a full body scan, checking my neck and my back and my head. But another reason is it was Memorial Day weekend and it was beautiful out and there was just a bunch of accidents. And so Sadia, my partner, finally came back with some answers and she said, it's going to be a while because there was a big bicycle accident, and it was involving head trauma. So it was just like, it was a bad day for more people than just me in Maryland.
And you did finally get surgery. Was it the same day? It wasn't, you didn't wait overnight? I couldn't remember from the narrative.
It was that same day. By the time I got out of that first surgery, so these, you know, I didn't know it at the time, obviously, but these first surgeries are kind of stabilizing surgeries. Mm-hmm. The trauma surgeon is going to go in, do what they call debriding. You're cleaning out the wound, cutting away dead tissue, kind of getting a sense of what all is going on in there. And so I don't know how many hours that first surgery was, but by the time I got out, I was able to see Sadia, was kind of put back into a room. It was late at night. So it was, you know, I went out in the ride for a ride in the morning, and then, I don't know, 8 o'clock, 10 o'clock, something late at night, dark, I finally kind of get to the hospital room where it's going to be my new home for a while.
So how was that first night?
Oh, my God. Yeah, that first night was really terrible. It's the only time in my life that I've really understood what people mean when they try to describe indescribable pain. Because the rest of my experience, I kind of was able to get medicated more or less. We might talk about that. But that first night, the surgeon had left because, as I said, it was late. And they leave these kind of generic instructions. And so the generic instruction for me that first night was I could get low-dose oxycodone because I was what's called opioid naive. I had never had opioids before this. So it only took a little bit to provide analgesia, to provide pain relief. So I would get that every 4 hours. And then in between, every 4 hours, in between that 4 hours, I could get IV fentanyl, so this really powerful opioid through my IV. And so that left 2 hours to get between. So I'd get, you know, at 10 p.m. oxycodone, at midnight fentanyl, at 2 a.m. oxycodone, and so on.
But you're on your own for 2 hours, basically.
On my own for 2 hours. Yeah, and there's a huge difference between getting one of these really heavy IV hits of fentanyl and getting a relatively small dose of oral oxycodone. And so every time I have that 2 hours where I can only get the oxycodone, I'm getting further behind the pain. And so, you know, you have in these sorts of situations, you're constantly being asked, what level is your pain on a scale from 0 to 10, with 0 being no pain and 10 being the worst imaginable? What's your pain? And I can't imagine in my life that I ever would have rated my pain as more than like a 4 or 5. I've had broken bones. But everything that hurt, I would have always thought like, oh, I could scale this up in my imagination so much, right? But into that night, I started creeping up thinking, oh, my God, this is a 7. Oh, my God, it's getting worse. This is an 8. And it got to the point where the meds just weren't doing very much anymore.
And the pain scale is something you discuss quite a bit in the book because it's one of the few tools patients have to communicate pain. As you said, it's a scale of 1 to 10. We've all seen the charts in the doctor's office with sad faces and happy faces depending on where you are on the scale. So I want to play a clip now, silly as it sounds, from the medical drama Grey's Anatomy. The character you're going to hear from came into the hospital after years of chronic head pain that he said was always an 8.
I've seen 39 doctors. I've tried every kind of painkiller and nothing helps. I've had doctors tell me it's my imagination. That I'm crazy. Call me a drug addict. My wife died last year. After spending years carting me around, doctor after doctor, test after test, she died. She was my best friend. She was my favorite person. And she died. And I couldn't feel it. I couldn't feel that pain because I was so completely occupied with this one.
So I included that because they ask him several times throughout the episode what his pain level is. And he says it's an 8. It's always an 8. And the doctors all roll their eyes behind his back. Of course, they do discover, because it's a medical drama, a rare condition that they're able to surgically fix and he's fine. But, you know, his pain is taken by them as exaggerated. But I think it's a good example of how, to him, the pain actually numbed him from existence. Is that something that you can connect with when you hear a story like that?
Oh, man, there's so much in that clip to talk about. I could teach a whole bioethics class on that, you know, 30-second clip or whatever. Yeah, I mean, so the most immediate thing that I can relate to is this intimate first personal knowledge of what your existence, what your experience is like, and knowing that you can never communicate that to somebody, right? There is this incredible barrier between me and you, between you and your doctor, between anyone and their doctor, which is they can't get inside your head, right? Mm-hmm. And so if I go in with a broken arm, or if I go in with my foot blown apart from a motorcycle accident, or if I go in with a headache, I'm going to have to tell them something that they absolutely cannot confirm. And it's all on them to believe me or not. And I am completely vulnerable in that moment. I'm completely at their mercy. And this is the great puzzle of pain. This is what makes pain medicine so hard. And if you believe what I write in my book, this is one of the reasons we have so much trouble with painkillers and with opioids and the way we practice pain, is because there's this deep philosophical puzzle right at the heart of what we're doing.
And how high did you rate your pain in the hospital? What did you ever get to a 10?
On that first night, I finally did. And it's the only time in my life I did. You know, I was on painkillers for months after this, and I had many, many surgeries. But that night, it kept steamrolling. And I remember being trained as a philosopher and being a very strange human, as all of us who go through graduate school in philosophy are. I remember thinking to myself about rating pain. How could I ever rate my pain a 10? Because 10 is the worst pain imaginable. And couldn't I, at any moment, imagine ratcheting up my pain level? So whatever it is in that moment, could I not just imagine it taking it up just a little more? And at one point, very, very late that night, early into the next morning, I had just gotten a dose of oxycodone, and it didn't even dull the escalating pain. And I started to panic. And it turns out, I didn't know this at the time, but panicking is one of the worst things that you can do, mm-hmm. because panic actually can loop back in and catastrophize your own pain. And so the panic snowballs into more pain, which causes more panic, which causes more pain. And I eventually am just yelling for my sweet, sweet nurse, who was terrified and didn't know what to do. And that was when I finally told him, my pain's a 10. And, you know, he had watched me all night just, you know, writhe and have trouble breathing, calling it an 8, maybe an 8.5, you know, finally a 9. And when I said 10, he was scared, and he gave me an extra dose of meds.
And how did you get back ahead of it? Or did you ever, when you were in the hospital? At some point, you did get visited by someone who had a little bit more practiced pain management skill. And they also worked in IV Tylenol at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. So that first night, I got back ahead of the pain just with the extra dose. It was just kind of enough mm-hmm. to catch me up, and then the schedule worked. And then as the hospitalization continued, they would escalate my dose as needed. And that everything hurt. Life wasn't great, but I was kind of okay for the following weeks and the following surgeries. What got really bad again was after my fifth surgery, which was a very major surgery. It's called a free flap, where they take a bunch of tissue from one part of your body, and cut it away, and then use it to plug a hole in another part of your body. That's my crude description. I'm sure any docs listening will not like my language. Plug a hole.
Makes sense to me.
That's right. You take muscle and fat, you plug the hole. Because there's enough tissue there, you have to vascularize it. So they put a new artery in that they have to microsurgically attach. Because it's going to cover a big chunk of my foot, they need me to have sensation. So they put a nerve in, which they have to microsurgically attach. And then they cover it with skin. So this is a huge surgery. It's not only doing a lot of stuff to my foot, but they have to take that tissue from somewhere. So I then have a new surgical site on my thigh that runs from my knee to my hip. And in the wake of that one, that's when the pain really went through the roof.
So give me the time frame. How long were you inpatient? And then how long did, I mean, you had 5 surgeries at first. I mean, I know you had more later on, but kind of in this first, was it 5?
Yeah. So 5, what you can think of as limb salvage surgeries. It was mm-hmm. 5 surgeries that determined whether I got to keep my foot. Mm-hmm. And those occurred over about 4 weeks. And they were actually in 3 different hospitals.
Okay.
So it was a little bit spread out. I would get to go home between some of the surgeries. Like after the third one, I got to go home and rest for a few days. So yeah, it was kind of a complicated time frame, but it was about 5 weeks after I got out of the ICU from the last one, and then spent the rest of the time on the floor. So at the end of that fifth surgery, it was about 5 weeks out from the accident.
And we're getting a little bit close to the break, but then there is another important phase of your recovery coming, and that was when you were sent home with painkillers, but you were still very much a patient, just a patient at home.
Yeah, and that's a weird transition for patients like me, because as a trauma patient, I'd had all these surgeries. I'd had all of this acute kind of re-traumatizing pain. The surgeons keep cutting on you. And after that, you go home, and there are no more immediate goals, no more things to get through. Life is just pain. And so it was a lot of watching the clock every 4 hours, making sure I was on time to take more pills. And that's kind of what I did for, weeks.
My guest this hour is Travis Reeder. He's the director of the Master of Bioethics degree program, the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. His book is called In Pain, A Bioethicist's Personal Struggle with Opioids. Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Travis Reeder. His book is called In Pain, A Bioethicist's Personal Struggle with Opioids. So Travis, when we last left off, you were headed home from the hospital. You'd had 5 surgeries over about a month period at different institutions, and you were sent home to recover, and you were sent home with opioids. Tell me kind of how you were managing your pain from home.
Yeah, so at this point in my recovery, I really feel separated from the healthcare system. We're going out for appointments every once in a while, but it's mostly long, long days at home, sleeping a lot because of the effect of the opioids. And the only instruction I really got about the painkillers was don't get behind the pain, which I was acutely aware of, right? Given that first night in the hospital. And so every 4 hours, popping oxycodone, and I was also on the extended release version, OxyContin, twice a day. And the thing about opioids is tolerance kicks in pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And so every few days, the pain would get a little bit worse a little bit earlier. And I'd put up with it as long as I could, call my prescribing doctor, who is the plastic surgeon, and say, I think I need to up the dose. He'd say, that's fine. On your next prescription, we'll write it for the next one. And so every few days, we're upping the dose. And that's how I survived for the next month or so after I got home from the hospital.
And then all of a sudden, you see a doctor that isn't your plastic surgeon, and he's basically like, it's time to stop the drugs.
Yeah, the initial trauma surgeon, it was just a follow-up, checking on the bones, seeing how everything is going. What he's most concerned at this point is bone infection. Mm-hmm. And he's going through the pain and pain medicine questions, and we do the math and kind of say, okay, this is how much we're on. And he just turns real serious and says, that's too much. It's too long. You need to get off the meds now, which caught us totally by surprise.
And it's kind of funny because you had said you were a little proud of yourself. You'd stretched the doses a little bit and you felt like you were kind of making progress, and he shut you down pretty quickly.
Yeah. When he's asking what your dose is like, I did. I felt kind of proud of myself because I had finally started on my own accord, no one ever saying anything. I had stretched to about 6 hours between doses instead of the normal 4. And I thought I was just being super responsible. And then he says, no, you're on a huge amount. And the amount, they measure everything in morphine equivalents. And so now what I can do is go back and add it up. And it was about 170 morphine milligram equivalents a day, which is quite a lot for anybody.
So what's interesting is this is kind of the turning point of the book, because he said it's time to stop using this medication this way, and then he told you to call someone else to figure out how.
Yeah, he did not see this as his job. He didn't offer any recommendation. He asked who'd been prescribing, and I said the plastic surgeon. He said, okay, go talk to him, and he'll give you a tapering schedule, which was the first time, of course, anybody had ever said you'll need to taper off these meds, which I think I intuitively understood.
Sure.
But nobody had ever said, hey, watch out. Like, you're going to be on a high dose for a long time. There's a problem with dependence here. You may withdraw. So we went to the plastic surgeon. And by contrast, he was just completely unconcerned. He's like, oh, yeah, if your pain's getting better, go ahead. Cut your daily dose into 4 and drop a quarter each week and you'll be done in a month.
So how did that go?
Not well. I don't recommend it. It's terrible advice. And so one thing that listeners should know, kind of the Cliff Notes version, is 25% drop per week is way too much. And maybe some people could have done it. Personal tolerance dependence varies widely. But I was clearly pretty sensitive to the effects of the drugs. And I went into real serious withdrawal immediately. So, the half-life on these medications is pretty short. And so the very first day that I cut a dose out, I started getting quite ill, and you get all of the symptoms of the flu kind of dialed up to 1,000, and there's a process to it. And so those flu-like symptoms go and they get worse and they peak And depending on kind of how much you've reduced your dose and where you are in the withdrawal, it can start adding in other symptoms like jitters and your internal thermostat goes haywire. Basically, withdrawal is the opposite of the effect of the drug you're on, is your brain tries to kind of correct itself. And so opioids cause euphoria, happiness. They cause analgesia, pain relief. They cause constipation. It's a side effect a lot of people know about. They cause sedation. That's why you're sleepy on them. It's also why they can kill you, because they can sedate you to overdose. So the opposite of all those things are the symptoms of withdrawal. You become kind of broadly ill, but instead of being euphoric, you're dysphoric. You are depressive, anxious. Instead of having pain relief, you have hyperalgesia, so you're incredibly sensitive to the pain. So the pain goes through the roof while you're withdrawing. And instead of being sedated, you're kind of jittery and fiery and can't sleep and insomniac. And all of those things get worse the more you try to reduce the dose.
And that's what I was going to ask you next. This is not like this happened on day one and then gradually you got better. This happened on day one through day done.
Yeah, exactly. And so that first week, I try to remember what it was like, and I think I just had more energy to fight it. And that first week was the only week where on the last day, I actually did feel a tick better, which is about what you would expect from kind of a normal symptom curve, that it takes about a week to start to get over the worst, the peak of the withdrawal. And so I kind of thought, okay, maybe I can do this. But then I had to drop another dose immediately after because the next week was the schedule. And then the higher the proportion of your dose that you reduce, the worse the withdrawal symptoms. I know that's kind of a mouthful, but
no, it's like math, basically.
Yeah. So, you know, you think about, I took the starting dose of 170 milligrams and cut it into four. And so that first week I was cutting 25% or 1/4. But then you're at this other dose, and when you drop the next week, you're cutting a third of it. You're cutting 33%. And then you're at, you know what, 85 milligrams. And that third drop, you cut it by a half. And then the last week you have to cut all of it. And so it's very common, not that I knew this at the time, it's very common for people to do well through part of their taper and then fail or give up or decide, you know, that they can't do it if they don't, if they aren't getting proper support late in the game, because that's when things always get worse.
And I think most people think of withdrawal as sweating or throwing up. And, you know, that's what we see in the movies when someone is coming off of heroin or, you know, a famous rock star is, you know, in withdrawal, which is what we see in like every biopic there ever has been. But one thing I don't think I was incredibly aware of was the depression that can lead right to suicide. Can you talk to me a little bit about what withdrawal does to your mood and your mental health?
Yeah, it was by far the most surprising part for me too, because I'm with you. Like, my only familiarity with withdrawal was TV and movies, and so yeah, you know, this is gonna suck for a day. I'm gonna sweat and throw up. Unfortunately, that's not all that happens. And for me, by far the worst part was the depression, because it's not something I've had to deal with, and so I didn't understand what was happening, and so. As the symptoms got worse and the depression really started to eat away at me, you know, I thought that I just had insight. You know, from inside my own head, I thought, oh, it's not that I'm depressed. It's not that my brain is misfiring. It's that I recognize that I'm basically broken and I will never be okay. And I had a 1.5-year-old at the time, and I thought, I'll never be a good father to her. I'm already ruining her life. She's watching her dad just cry all day, every day, not be able to sleep, run to the bathroom to try to throw up. Like, I'm ruining my family's life. And eventually those sorts of really dark thoughts take you to a really scary place where you start thinking, what would be best for the world? What would be best for everyone who loves me? It would be best if I wasn't here anymore.
And your daughter, in her kind of 1.5-year-old pure-hearted wisdom, really did try to kind of help you in her own little way.
She did. It's, you know, it's one of the most memorable parts of the storytelling in the book, I think, for a lot of people. But yeah, I don't remember so much of her, except kind of shining little moments that break through the fog. And, you know, one of them, I remember her doing physical therapy on the floor with me and counting my reps, you know, in her little 1.5-year-old voice, counting up to 10. And then at one of my very worst moments of my life, probably the worst moment of my life, I remember her walking in and and kissing my eyes and holding my face and giving me a hug. And I'm like, how does a 1.5-year-old have that sort of deep wisdom? I don't know. But don't care. It was, you know, she helped me get through it.
And there has been documentation that withdrawal has led people to suicide. I mean, people have left notes before saying they just can't take it. I mean, this is not just depression of the moment. It can send people somewhere really serious.
Yeah, and so some of what I talk about in the book that's related to these suicides is a kind of different case where, you know, people who have been on opioids for very long term are now being forced into withdrawal because in this moment, of course, as a country, we're terrified of what's happening with the opioid crisis, and that's creating a lot of fear and even more stigma with opioid therapy. And so a really serious concern right now is what's happening to these pain patients, some of whom are being abandoned and who are far worse off than I was because many of them have been on opioids for years or even decades, and the doses they're on are just unimaginable. You know, I said 170 milligrams was what I was on, and that's a very high dose. It's considered dangerously high, about twice the level of dangerously high, as a matter of fact. But some of these people are on 800 milligrams or 1,000 milligrams or even more. And so withdrawal for them can seem never-ending, and I just can't even imagine it. So, yeah, some of the kind of anecdotal literature that's coming up about people being driven to suicide is a combination of pain, despair, and withdrawal as they feel like they're just being left for dead by the medical establishment.
Speaking of, who did you reach out to during withdrawal? You weren't just, you know, gritting your teeth. You were trying to figure out how to do this better.
Yeah, no, this was not a story of a tough guy who pulled himself up by his bootstraps, right? Like Sadia and I were calling everyone we could think of. And at the beginning, that just started with our prescriber. And he just kind of said, sorry. So good for him. He actually said the words, I'm sorry. He said, I'm out of my depth here, but I don't know what to do. So why don't you just go back on the meds until we can figure this out? But by that point, I felt really pot committed, right? Because I had already suffered long enough that I thought I'll never make myself do this again. And so going back on the dose to kind of stabilize myself meant either going through all of that again or just kind of giving up internally and saying, guess what? I'm going to be on opioids for the rest of my life. And so we stuck with it and tried other people. And we called everyone. You know, we called a pain management team, that the pain doc that you mentioned earlier, who kind of got my pain under control after the fifth surgery. They wouldn't speak with us. They had a nurse tell us that it wasn't their job to taper or manage withdrawal. It was their job as an inpatient service to get patients comfortable, not to deal with the kind of back end. We heard that from a different pain management clinic that we'd never been a patient with, but were just trying to get help. Most prescribers wouldn't talk to us. Some of them that did told us to go to the emergency room, especially late in that month when the symptoms got pretty scary. And they'd say, you know, you're in some danger, go to the emergency room. And we'd ask, and what'll they do? And they'd say, well, they'll put you back on opioids until you stabilize. And then they eventually told us to go to addiction medicine, which the particular advice was kind of spectacularly bad. One woman told me to go to a methadone clinic, which was not what I needed, precisely because methadone it is a long-term opioid that you transition people onto to stabilize them. But I was trying to get help weaning off, which is not what a methadone clinic specializes in. But also they triage, right? They're dealing with patients whose lives are really in shambles due to addiction. And so when I finally said, well, okay, I'll call these places, they very sweetly but straightforwardly told me, you're not our job, right? Somebody should have just handled you. You had surgery, you got hurt, you were on pain meds. They should have just tapered you off. You know, we deal with people who are kind of burning their lives down in pursuit of this drug, and that's not you.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. And since this all happened, what's been interesting is you've gotten a lot of clarity after from different people. And for example, I think the CDC tweeted at you their tapering recommendations, but one of the first things, the cardinal rules you learn, is that you don't ever tell someone who's withdrawing to go back on their medication.
Yeah, it's really quite bad advice. And what you can certainly do is you can tell them to pause their taper and collect themselves. And so what somebody should have done as soon as it got unmanageable was say, Travis, don't drop the next dose, collect yourself, the withdrawal symptoms will taper away. You know, collect yourself, find support somewhere. And by the way, sorry, that's not me. It's what somebody should, right? But, you know, pause. but never go back on the meds. And the reason is when you up your dose, or if you've gone off and then you retake that previous dose, you're giving yourself an additional reward, right? Mm-hmm. And so, I just went to some lengths to say I wasn't the purview of addiction medicine. And that's because I was dealing with physiological dependence. And that's different from addiction. Everybody who gets put on opioids at a high enough dose for long enough, their brain will adjust because of dependence. They will become dependent on the drug. And that means that they'll have some amount of withdrawal when you take it away. That's just how brains work. But a relatively small number of people will actually develop an addiction, which is this further health condition, what's often called a disease of the brain's reward and motivation centers. And that reward center is really key, because what's happening there is you're learning kind of pathologically to overvalue something that's not valuable, namely a drug, and then pursue it at all costs, even when it hurts you, when it hurts everything that you care about. That's what characterizes addiction. So that's not really where I was, but that's the kind of landscape that we have to get really straight on.
And I don't want to make everyone think that this was the end for you. Obviously, we're talking and you don't sound like you're in the throes of withdrawal. So you got to the point where you put your prescription bottle on the bedside table and you were in desperation going to maybe take one, but you decided to try to fall asleep and see if you could go to sleep without it. And what happened?
Yeah, I mean, so this is where I just have to emphasize how lucky I was. And mm-hmm. it's really one of the things that led me to make this my work. You know, I'm a professor. I ended up writing articles on this and then eventually published this book. And the reason was I figured out that I wasn't idiosyncratic. Like, that was mm-hmm. the first lesson I just thought, man, how unlucky did I get? 3 major hospitals, dozens of doctors, no one could help me. But of course, I wasn't unlucky. I was exactly every patient, right? Well, obviously not every, that's hyperbole,
but a lot
who are falling through the cracks. And so that night that you're describing from the book, I had given up. I had decided I'm going back on the meds because I was scared. My partner was scared. We were afraid that I would hurt myself, that I wouldn't come out of this. And so we filled a new prescription and I put it by my bed on the nightstand. And I committed that night to taking more pills until I finally got some rest and could think clearly about what to do next. But I knew in my heart that if I went back on the meds, I was never going to go through this again. I was committed to a life on opioids. And it just so happens that I fell asleep that night before I took anything. And I actually slept. And I kind of broke through the worst of the symptoms. I slept for about 6 hours. And when I woke up, I certainly didn't feel objectively good, but I thought, okay, I'm going to survive this.
Is that some of the sweetest relief you've ever felt?
The best feeling in the life, despite not feeling all that great, might have been able to fly, right?
My guest this hour is Travis Reeder. He's director of the Master of Bioethics degree program at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. His book is called In Pain, A Bioethicist's Personal Struggle with Opioids. KERA in Dallas. This is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Travis Reeder. His book is called In Pain, A Bioethicist's Personal Struggle with Opioids. So when we left off, we were talking about your serious withdrawal, Travis, and then when the fog kind of lifted, I won't say you were better because you were still in enormous pain, but all of a sudden you could cope with the fact that you weren't taking this medication anymore. And I'm guessing that gave you immediate relief, but then you had the horrible specter looming over you that another surgery was going to happen down the road.
Yeah, so this was the most terrifying sort of eventuality I could imagine, because I had this incredible gratitude that I had made it out. And I had this very unsophisticated view, and I should mark up front here so that no one stops listening and takes away that this is how I end, right? But I had this very unsophisticated view that opioids were basically like black magic, right? Mm-hmm. They had ruined my life. They had ruined my family's life for some time. And the only reason that wasn't permanent was because I was just so fortunate. And I just wanted to never touch them again. And I didn't want to think about them. I didn't want to talk about them. But I was going to have another surgery. So those first 5 limb salvage surgeries kind of put the foot back together. But you have all of this tissue stuck, in something like a foot shape. And then it takes 6 months or so before the swelling fully really goes down and everything's kind of at a state where we know what the foot's going to look like. And then I have to see a plastic surgeon who's going to start carving and shaping and make it look like a foot so it can fit in supportive footwear so that I can wear real shoes. I don't develop hip and leg problems. And that's a really painful surgery. These sorts of plastic surgeries where they're cutting all sorts of tissue, that's not something – well, I asked. I finally started asking some friends. You know, I'm faculty at Johns Hopkins. I'm friends with lots of doctors.
Right.
And I started asking them. I was like, can I go through this surgery without opioids? And I remember one of my good friends looked at me and her eyes got kind of wide and she said, you really don't want to do that, Travis. She was right. I mean, I didn't want to, but I also didn't want to take the pills. So I didn't know what to do.
So how did you approach it this time? Obviously, when your first accident happened, you didn't have time to make a plan on the front end, and then you didn't know to make a plan on the back end. But now you had gone through 4 weeks of excruciating withdrawal, and you knew you were going to likely have to take at least some amount of opioids. How did you plan for that?
Well, so I enacted let's be honest, my privilege. So I work at a place like Johns Hopkins. I start talking. I start expanding my little circle of people who know what happened to me. And several of them say, well, Travis, you have resources here. Find someone. And finally, that same friend who told me, you know, you don't want to do this without drugs, she recommended that I see a particular person. So I name him in the book, so I won't feel bad about using his real name. But Dr. Michael Erdek is a pain interventionist here at Hopkins. And she said, look, we know him. You know, he came and gave a talk. I'm sure he'd talk with you, and it would probably be reassuring. So I emailed him, and he immediately set up an appointment with me. And so basically, yeah, I went on a fact-gathering mission. I didn't go to him for pain medicine. I went to him to tell me how to survive this, you know, without going back down this rabbit hole.
And you've gone to great lengths in the book to kind of acknowledge your privilege. You're a white man. You're educated. You have access to a lot of the medical community. You also make a point to acknowledge the fact that that is not at all the case for so many people who are probably in the same boat or even worse off than you were. Can you kind of draw a distinction about what some people are up against?
Yeah, I mean, so again, this is how I came to finally convince myself to work on this publicly, because as you might imagine, this is not the most fun thing for me to talk about this terrible time in my life and to write it publicly. And, you know, my partner and I had to decide that we were going to make very intimate facts about our life public knowledge. That was hard, and the reason we did it was because we were haunted by this fact that it was this hard for me. It was this hard for me given all of the privilege that I have. And so now let's think about what other sorts of populations might have it harder. Well, anyone who doesn't work at a place like Hopkins and can't eventually get access of this sort, right? But also people whose testimony are taken less seriously. So I review a lot of the literature in the book that says, look, if you're a white man, you have your words taken more seriously in a healthcare context than anybody else. So people who are Black, who are Hispanic, women, they are more likely to have, for instance, their pain testimony disregarded and to be less well medicated, right? So there's all of this going on where I had all of the cards that society deals out, and I still fell through the cracks. And we're just sitting back going, holy cow, how many people are going into the healthcare system right now who are being put on these medications, given no information, being discarded back into society with no help whatsoever, and have it way worse than me? Oh, yeah, not to mention the fact that I have an incredible support network in my family and so much to work towards and you know, people who would, my parents would come and live with me. Like, how many people are going home by themselves without someone to take care of them, who don't have the money, who are going to lose their job? Like, my job was secure even as I stayed home. So, like, I think we get the point here. I'm torn apart. I'm kept awake at night by the fact that this can happen even when you have all of the cards, which means there must be a population of people out there that's enormous who have it even worse.
And kind of makes you think about the expression falls through the cracks. I mean, it's not really a crack, is it? Is it more like a ravine or
it's
a large
a chasm?
Ditch?
Yes. Like, our healthcare system is just fractured wide open at every single angle, you know, crisscrossing one another. And so, yeah, you get handed off between surgical teams, you get handed off between healthcare systems, between insurers, between hospitals. And, you know, once I started thinking about this, it was completely unsurprising that this issue that I'm pointing to is there, that patients don't get well educated about their pain medicine and they don't have the kind of follow-up and care long term that would help them use it in a way that prevents future harm. Like, this is unsurprising in a system that looks about like ours.
Let's take a call now. We're going to go to Barry in San Antonio. Barry, you can go ahead with your question.
Thank you. I was wondering if some drugs, painkillers, are more difficult to shed or recover from than standard opioids.
Good question. Is there another way to go?
Interesting. So I don't know if he's able to come back, but
yeah,
Barry, I wonder if your question is, are there non-opioids that also have these challenges, or are you asking if some opioids are worse than others?
More or less, some opioids are worse than others. I can give you the name if you want it, but I was in the hospital for 2 months with back surgery, and they tried to prevent maintenance with traction. They hooked me up on Demerol from 25 milligrams all the way up to 100 milligrams every 3 hours. When I got out, that was a real fun time. All I had was a couple of 10 milligram tablets to fight the addiction.
Man, I'm sorry about that. And I have to say, like, you know, these stories are not uncommon now that I've been doing this for a while. I have to say I don't know a ton about Demerol, but there are lots of features of different medicines that work in different ways. So if you take the class of opioids, it's a big class. It's a class of drugs that is held together by the fact they interact with the body's opioid system. So it used to call something an opiate because it was ultimately derived from opium, the poppy plant. But it doesn't matter anymore because we synthesize this stuff in laboratories. So like fentanyl, like methadone, these don't have any relationship to opium in nature. You know, we built this stuff in a lab. So these are opioids because they work on the body's opioid system, which is in charge of these things that are obviously really important to us, like euphoria, but also like analgesia, and it does that through the dopamine system, so this reward system. That's like a quick science lesson, but the reason this is important is because not every opioid is exactly the same along various dimensions. So some of them are more potent. And what I mean by that is the same number of milligrams will have more of an effect. So 5 milligrams of morphine is less powerful than 5 milligrams of oxycodone, which is less powerful than 5 milligrams of fentanyl, right? You get the idea. So there's potency, and that's why we actually translate everything into morphine milligram equivalents. But there are also other things like half-life, and this is what makes it really complicated. So some opioids have a longer half-life, and that's what makes them more and less useful for different things. So methadone, for instance, has an incredibly long half-life, which is why we use it to treat addiction, because it kind of can stabilize a patient's brain. So I'm afraid that that's like a decent little science lesson that doesn't fully answer the question. But the point is that the class is really complicated. And so what somebody's problem is probably depends on what they're reacting to. And so some people get in trouble because they really like the intense high that you get with a high potency opioid like fentanyl. And then, of course, there are other classes of painkillers that are non-opioids but have some similar risks of dependence and even addiction risk. And that includes classes like gabapentin, which is a non-opioid but is also a painkiller. So I'm sorry if that didn't fully answer the question, but that's a little bit of like why it's so complicated.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. So I thought it was really interesting how you talked about how well the IV Tylenol worked for you when you were in the hospital and how it seemed so simple. And then you asked some colleagues about, I'm surprised they didn't use that more frequently. And they all started laughing. And why was that?
Because IV Tylenol, even though so it's called IV APAP usually, which stands for the scientific name, which is long and I can never remember it without reading it. acetyl para something. Well, you get the idea. So they call it IV APAP. And it's actually still on patent. So this sounds kind of crazy to us because acetaminophen in pill form has been off patent as generic for a very long time, so it's cheap. But IV acetaminophen, IV APAP, is under a brand name now. It's still on patent, and so it's incredibly expensive. And it doesn't sound that expensive. So when I eventually did my homework, you know, last I checked, it may have changed since then, but it was about a little north of $40 a vial. But the comparison here is morphine, which is pennies, right? And so if you're using doses of IV APAP, this is orders of magnitude more expensive. So the point of that story was when I said this to a group of anesthesiologists just to pick their brain, they all laughed because they were in on the joke. one of my doctors told me I couldn't get any more IV acetaminophen, and he made up something about it was bad for my liver, which all acetaminophen has similar risk for your liver, right? But they were laughing because they're saying, no, he couldn't give it to you because they probably had hospital orders. You can't use something expensive when something cheap will do, because they're trying to cut costs, to try to keep healthcare costs from spiraling out of control.
So instead, turn to the highly habit-forming opioid.
Exactly. And so, you know, it turns out that when I really did my homework on this, the case of IV APAP is very complicated. There's literature out there that supports what I found, which is in my own case, it was as good as morphine in the short term. So that's why I was so interested in, is when the pain management doc gave me IV APAP to kind of help get through, catch up to the pain between, you know, the opioid doses. Every time he gave it to me, I only got three of them over 2 days. Mm-hmm. That was just as good as morphine. A bunch of literature says something like that. And then there's a bunch of literature that says it's no more powerful than acetaminophen in oral form, which we're supposed to take is not that potent for severe pain. But of course, this is all relative to very specific pains, very specific injuries. So the literature is actually pretty messy. And right now, there's a lot of hospitals who are like, given that, don't use IV APAP. It's too expensive.
So as you go through this book and you make the big decision to kind of share your story, and you really engage the attention of a lot of your colleagues when you do, it's a hard question to ask, but where do you think this system is most broken down? Is it the whole not it situation you ran into with doctors who everyone you turned to said, that's really not my purview? Where do you think we've kind of gone so wrong on treating pain and helping people on the backside?
Yeah, so if you're making me pick one, I think the not it is a really big problem. It's kind of where I started in my research. It's where I end up. But, you know, note that when we start talking about opioids, there are really big conversations. And so I talk about pain and how it intersects with opioids and our use in pain medicine. But, of course, there's this other piece, too, which is that we have an opioid epidemic in the country, which is only partially related to pain medicine, because some of that is heroin and illicit fentanyl. And so there are different things that can be broken when it comes to opioids, right? The intersection that I got really interested in this book is kind of where all three come together. So where are we so bad at pain medicine using opioids that we're actually exacerbating America's opioid crisis, right? And I think one of those places is this problem that you eloquently call the not it problem, which is that doctors are so uninterested, so unwilling, so scared in a lot of cases of using opioids in the long term, because that's when they're scary. When you use them in the long term, that's what makes you think that maybe you're dealing with suspicious patients or patients who might have an addiction, who need something that's very stigmatized, right? They just don't want to be involved in that. So a lot of doctors have been comfortable over the last decades writing that first script. They may have a happy customer. Someone walks out, their broken arm feels better now, but they really don't want to be dealing with a patient who's going through withdrawal, because who does that look like? A person going through withdrawal looks like someone who's dealing with addiction. Don't want to deal with that. And so then there's all these steps in the middle of actually following up and knowing, like, pretty complicated science of how opioids work, not to mention using an evidence base that we didn't have.
My guest this hour was Travis Reeder, director of the Master of Bioethics degree program at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. His book is called In Pain, A Bioethicist's Personal Struggle with Opioids. Travis, thank you so much for your time. What a great conversation.
Thanks for having me on, Courtney. I really enjoyed it.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. Subscribe to our podcast and find out about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Courtney Collins, and for Chris Boyd, thanks for listening and have a great day.